These tapes are produced in the spirit of AA's 12th step to carry the message. Members of this fellowship should bear in mind AA's 11th tradition regarding anonymity at the level of press, TV, and films, and use of these tapes. Anonymity to this extent is actually the practice of genuine humility. We are sure that humility expressed by anonymity is the greatest safeguard that AA could ever have.
Newly to Colorado, Jerry. New to Colorado? And very new to Queens, because I don't think he's ever been here. Never been here. And Don, also from Colorado, and let's get this thing going.
My name's Don. I'm an alcoholic. It's working all right, I presume? Okay. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is known as an AA group. That's how we're registered. The long form of the third tradition says that any two or more alcoholics gathered for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, so we do. We meet at 6 o'clock in the morning in the basement of a correctional facility, so we don't have a whole lot of dead weight. You gotta really want to be there. I have been continuously sober since December 26th of 1967. And I tell you that because I want to impress you. Not with me. You need to be impressed with the fact that relapse is not part of recovery. That if you're an alcoholic, you don't ever have to drink again. Ever. And this weekend, we're going to explore some of that. One of the things Jerry and I will do, of course, is share our experience. We'll try not to give you a whole lot of information. We have become aware since we got here that we're in a hotbed of experts. I've seen some of you even writing your big books. My God, that means you've read them at least. But the viewpoint that we're going to approach the weekend with will be very important. You can read this and die. You can read this and become so damn good that you're not good for anything. Viewpoint's going to be very important. We'll share experience. I'm a storyteller. I don't know a whole lot except how to tell stories. And I almost stopped doing these once. I might as well share that. This gets tiresome. I've been doing this for 27 years. And along the way, you pick up a reputation and you become an expert and you become this and that. And I just got tired of that. And I was back in Rhode Island, I think. And I mentioned to Ruthie that I was tired of it, and I was just going to quit. I didn't want to do this anymore. And she said, look, when you show up, it's like having our uncle or our grandpa show up and tell us stories. And we all love to hear the same stories over and over again. And if you'll come, we'll all get together. And that's why I'm here, not because I'm an expert. But if I show up, you seem to come. And that's a good enough reason for me to be here. If you'll all get together, that's a good enough reason for me to be here. The only other thing I had planned this weekend was to spend some time with the woman that I love more than life itself. So that you'll know what I feel about you, I'm here, not there. And she and I both understand that the reason we have what we have, I've been married to the same woman for 21 years, and we haven't had a fight yet. And the reason for that is because we get together, and you send me home calm, cool, and horny. And she likes it. That's the way it is. I'm going to let Jerry introduce himself, and then we've got a chore to take care of.
My name's Jerry, and I am an alcoholic. We really do appreciate you all letting us come out here and provide you with an excuse to get together. I found it unnecessary to take a drink since January the 17th, 1977. I'm in the process of changing my home group. My home group about a month ago was a little group down in Plainfield, Mass, Plainville Mass. It's a little group that met on Thursday nights at 7 o'clock, 7 to 8. The little Catholic church in Plainville. And you'd always be welcome if you showed up there on a Thursday night at 7 o'clock. I recently moved to Denver, arrived there about 3.5 weeks ago. And Don has been a very dear friend for a long time. And so I said, what meeting are you going to? And that was a mistake. He said, well, I have two. The real meeting is on Friday morning at 6 o'clock. And I said, what are my other options? And he said, York Street at 7 o'clock on Thursday morning. So right now I'm in the process of making both of those, albeit that the AA group that meets on Friday morning at 6 o'clock appears to be my home group at this time. You know the old expression, if you want what we have, then come and do what we do. My story is just a little bit different than Don's, only in the sense that I am an expert. I can tell you all the things that you should not do. I've made most of the mistakes that can be made in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've made most of the mistakes. We're going to talk to you a lot about our experiences in walking on a particular spiritual path. And I will share some experiences with you on how not to do that, knowing full well that you're probably going to do it anyway. I had to. But it is a grand deal. What I didn't realize for a long time, even after I'd come into Alcoholics Anonymous, 13 years to be exact, was that I needed a solution for more than just not drinking. I really, truly did. See, I was a lucky one in that I was totally beaten at the time that I was given the gift of physical sobriety. And then I thought once I had laid the drink down, that was all I needed to do. I didn't realize my alcoholism was going to go on. And over any considerable length of time, we get worse. And there's a lot of proof to that. In my whole life. And I was the only one who didn't know that. And I needed a solution. I needed a real solution, and I discovered that. 13 years into sobriety. Or 13 years away from a drink, we might put it that way, because I sure wouldn't classify what I had as sobriety. But I'll share a lot of that experience with you this weekend, if that's what you want to hear. But I'm kind of interested in getting clear as to what you all want to do. Because this is, first of all, to me, this is an AA meeting. I mean, I want to make it clear. I consider this an AA meeting. And as you hear my story, you'll understand why I am still confused as to why I'm sitting up here and you're sitting back out there. That still doesn't quite ring true to me, but I have the opportunity to make that experience, crazy as it was, of some value, and I'll share it with you to the best of my ability. But like I say, I really want to know kind of what it is that you guys want us to do, what you expect from us. I think I know, but we'll get clear on that. Again, I thank you for letting us be here. I've got a lot of dear friends that showed up. I'm making new ones, and I to those old friends that are here, I thank you for coming, and to those new friends that I'm making already in the short time I've been here, I thank you.
This is a new experience for both of us in that we have not done this together so far. We've done it together, but we've not done this together. This is about, alcoholism is about being separated from God and from my fellow man. Drinking is a symptom of that. And I feel separated right now. We're used to a group of 20, 30 people. And these tables are separating me from you and you from me, and it bothers me. And if I may make a request, is it possible that we could pick them up and set them against the wall and move these chairs in so we can see each other's eyeballs? Yeah. Can we do that?
Yeah. I wanted to do that, but I was afraid you'd get angry, and I'm so damn sensitive that I didn't want anybody mad at me.
Truly, they worked hard to get that done. I just come in and screwed their whole life up. But that's kind of what I do. One of the great masters mentioned that once you wake up, you're going to run around the countryside waking people up, and they don't always like it. I don't know if you've ever found that out working this deal. Some people don't like this. They don't want to wake up. Is this better? We'll adjust it all through the weekend. I expect one of the ways for me to approach what we're going to do this weekend, which is starting it with the big book, and we'll just go through it, because that's my own experience. I need to tell you that there was a time that I used this book to validate my experience. And today I can tell you that my experience validates this book. And that's the difference. And both are valid. If you need to use the book to validate your experience for a while, that's perfectly valid. My experience is a little different from the street. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in a penitentiary. So AA did not get me sober. God got me sober. And 5.5 months later brought me to AA so that the gift of life he had given me could take on some meaning and some dimension and some purpose. Christmas night of 1967, I took a 2-month supply of Dioxin and shot it up my arm, drank everything in the house, and laid down and died because I simply couldn't stand being me one more second. There was no more hope. From the time I was little, I knew there was something wrong with me. If you gave me an opportunity to write you up a list of all the qualities that I wish had been in the family that I grew up with, that's the family I grew up with. But I didn't fit. And it wasn't their fault. I'm the only alcoholic in my family. I have one old uncle who really tried. His doctor told him 20-some years ago, Walter, if you don't start drinking, you're going to die, and he quit. Just didn't have what it took. You got to be tough to be an alcoholic. This didn't come easy. You have to have willpower and stick-to-itiveness and a willingness to lay down wherever you happen to fall and stay there. You have to study hard to become a proficient liar, okay, to where it rolls off your tongue without any effort at all. Okay? That's hard work when your insides are telling you you'd much rather tell the truth, but you just can't. My little brother, oh, I love my little brother. He's a professor of music at the University of Colorado. Was riding with Stan Kenton when he was 19. Was booker for the Army Band when he was 21. Does a symphony for the Colorado Symphony every year. He just got back from Russia. They take him over every year to the Scandinavian countries and to Russia to teach for a month so they can try to figure out what the hell he does. I've seen him play an orchestra. He had 6 of his students on synthesizers, and he had his own, and he had earphones, and I'm watching him, and I saw what he was doing. He was improvising off of what these people were playing. Now, he grew up right down the hall from me, next room over. Okay. Yeah. I don't get to lay this off on upbringing. My little sister just a while back retired from IBM. She became one of their top executives, made great money and great babies. And her babies have been busy making babies. And because most of you young guys are idiots, we can't find husbands to go with them. But in my family, the whole attitude when a baby shows up is, isn't that nice? There's another prince baby, let's raise it. And we do. And I couldn't make myself fit that, and I wanted to so badly. Really, really wanted to. The only time I fit was when I drank alcohol. Alcohol did amazing things for me. It transformed me. You're all big book experts. I can tell you what alcohol did for me. Carl Jung described it. as a spiritual experience. Ideas and conceptions that used to run the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side, and an entire new set of conceptions begins to dominate. That's what happened when I took my first drink. I had what seemed to be a spiritual experience, and I am convinced that all of us hunger for that. And so whatever it is that gives us that is what we're going to hook on to. I also have a body that has a peculiar allergy. If I give it alcohol, it breaks out with a craving for more alcohol. Since we're here with a bunch of experts, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time in those first 50-some-odd pages convincing us, are we alcoholic? But I'm going to offer you a challenge. There's a worm in my head, and I assume there's a worm in your head, too, that likes to come out once in a while. And let's shine some light on him right away. Consider for a moment, if you will, this question. Is it possible that I'm not an alcoholic? Maybe I'm not. That's a scary thought. But if I don't take a look at that every now and then, that's going to show up. And it may show up on a day when there's a drink handy. And I'll take the test. Oh, my. I've already failed the test. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was supposed to go to a federal hospital in Fort Worth, Texas, because I was certified as a sociopath type 2, a psychopath, and a manic depressive drug addict. And the reason they had me certified as those is that if you looked at my behavior, that's what I looked like. I was hiding my alcoholism behind some really serious stuff. See, from the time I took my first drink until my last one, nobody, including me, had a clue that I was alcoholic. Because it was a part of my life, so much a part of my life nobody ever saw it. And if you start getting close, we gave you some real high drama. Okay. Drama does not define alcoholism. The inability to control your drinking defines alcoholism. The inability to stay away from alcohol after you know that you can't control it defines alcoholism. We blame alcoholism for an awful lot of our bad behavior and funky attitudes, don't we? That's typically alcoholic. I hear that all the time. Bullshit. As far as I know, from reading this book for a number of years, looking for symptoms, the only thing that's truly common about among all alcoholics is once they start to drink, they can't stop. That's the common symptom of all alcoholics. Rich, poor, white, black, tall, short, it doesn't matter. That's the common symptom. Once you start, you can't stop. You'd think that'd be simple. I've sponsored people that couldn't get that. Have you? I sponsored a psychiatrist one time. God, I loved him. He was one of the founders of the Pier 1 concept, University of Colorado in Colorado, one of the finest drug and alcohol treatment programs ever devised. He just couldn't stay sober. And when I sponsor people, we just sit down and I read the big book to you, because that's how I was sponsored. And I learned something early on, the real problem with most alcoholics is they can't read. So I'll read it to you, and then you and I will do what it says together, because they don't know how to follow directions either. Okay, I know I am one. The new improved always going to work better. Anyway, I'm reading the doctor's opinion to this doctor. And I'm watching him get lost among everything he knows. He didn't get it. And I'm praying hard. And I love new people because you teach me effective prayer. Oh, God, what am I going to say now? Oh, yeah. I just gave him everything I got, and he didn't get it. What am I saying now? I heard it come out of my mouth. I said, Don, what happens to you after the first drink? Oh, he says, after the fourth or fifth drink, I forget where I'm supposed to go next. And I said, take another drink, and I get lost, and I don't get where I'm supposed to go, and I get drunk. And I said, Don, what happens to you after the first drink? Oh, around the fourth or fifth drink, what happens to me after the first drink is the second drink. Okay? That's what the doctor's trying to tell us. He doesn't understand it either. He just knows it's an observable phenomena. If you're alcoholic and you take one, you will take another. I got my first duck feather from the book Alcoholics Anonymous in the doctor's opinion. I think the doctor's opinion is critical. If we don't tell people what alcoholics are, how in the hell are they going to know whether they are one or not? And this deal will work for anybody, I believe, but the foundation must be truth. I've got to know what's going on with me. That's the plague of my life. What's wrong with me? I was in my first federal penitentiary when I was 19 years old. Not because I was a big-time gangster. I've never been a big-time gangster, and I've been to three prisons. I'm careless. I get caught. Big-time gangsters don't even go once. I was in my first federal penitentiary in Japan when I was 19 because of alcoholism, and I found that in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. The doctors describes men he'd been working with who were going to have a decision that would be favorable to them, worked on a business deal, and they took a drink a day or two before, and they missed their appointment. Well, that was me. When I get lost, when I get drunk, I get lost and can't find my way home. And when you're in the Navy, that's a felony. They gave me a 24-hour liberty in Long Beach, California, and I had a drink of whiskey. And 23 days later, I was in Pershing Square in Los Angeles, mooching drinks and willing to do anything. I'd been doing anything. Things so completely against my character, it was eating me alive. But I did them because I needed a drink. Day 23 ended, and the madness left me, and I went back to my ship and turned myself in. And there I am. It would have been much better for me to be back on time. But once I start drinking, I can't quit. It took a lot of years for that information to get to me, and it came because my sponsors, when I first got sober, said, you new guys, for 5 weeks, have nothing to say. If you knew anything at all, you wouldn't be here. We had to, before we were allowed to go to the AA meeting, we had to go through a 12-step study school. We couldn't go to the regular meeting on Friday night where they let real people in from the outside. You had to qualify for that. We weren't worthy of that. True. That was the whole attitude. So we got to go through the steps in 5 weeks. And we didn't know you can't do that, so we just did it anyway. Over the weekend, I'll try to share some of the experiences I had with it. But let me start with this one. And I promised Jerry I was going to do a 4-hour meditation. He could do all the talking. This is a viewpoint that I wish to share with you that is the foundation of my life and the foundation of your life if you're going to work with me. It's in the foreword to the first edition. It tells me two things. It gives me the absolute truth and a promise, and then it tells me what my life work is going to be. It gives me back purpose. I died because I had no purpose. I was useless. We are more than 100 men and women who recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. As we approached this, it was important for me to understand I can get over whatever's wrong with me. Please, God, don't give me anything that teaches me how to cope with what's wrong with me. My coper's broken. There's no spare parts. To cope means to fight the good fight. I'm all out of fight. I don't get to be cured of anything, but I get to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. For me, that simply means I no longer suffer the symptoms of alcoholism. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I do not suffer from the craving that comes after the first drink because I haven't had that drink in 30 years. So how can I suffer from that one? It's gone. Nor do I suffer from the strange mental twist that caused me to pick up the first drink. I was given a new mind, and I use it for my life. I keep my alcoholic mind at hand for you. It's of no use to me whatsoever. But it's really important to you because you need to understand that I understand or you won't listen to me. To show others precisely how we've recovered, that's the purpose of this. I'm one of we in this book. We have done this thing, and having done it the way they said they did it, I had the same experiences that they had at about the same time. This is a wonderful book. All through here are checklists. You know, when you have a spiritual awakening, the first thing that happens is I think, whoops, I've lost my mind. And the reason for that is that I have. The one I've been using up to this point is gone. And there's a new one there, and I don't know how to use it. But it'll tell me certain things, and we'll cover them, too. It'll help me to understand you're not insane, you're just new. Now, that puts a great burden on me. As a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, first of all, I need to find out if you want to recover. Because if you don't, I'm not supposed to waste any of your time and prejudice a future opportunity. If you don't want to recover, don't do this. If you don't want what we have, don't do this. If you want what we have, this is all you have to do, and it'll work anyway. You can have a bad attitude about it. You can be pissed about it. You can even say, I don't believe it, but I'm going to do it. It'll work anyway. And what does that mean, to work? It doesn't mean I get to feel better. It means that I will develop a relationship with a power greater than myself that will solve my problem. That's what it means. And I have. And then I get to show you how I did that. And that's where the fun comes. I love sponsoring people. And you guys are far more interesting than television. Oh, really? Jerry, I'm about to go off on a tangent that will destroy this whole group of you.
Hell, I don't know. I was about to go with him, I. Oh, God, this is great. I've heard it before. I want to pick up a little thread, though. As most of you know, I was 13 years dry. And there's nothing more miserable than trying to not drink and live. I mean, and keep the same mind that you came in here with. What doesn't work right. And the only thing was, I didn't know that my mind didn't work right. From the time I can remember, when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I had a gnawing sensation in the pit of my stomach that was just always there. And if you were to have told me that that was fear, I'd say, no, it wasn't, because whatever it was, it had just always been there. I mean, just always been there. And when I was about 3, 3 and a half years old, I was walking down the street one day, and in this little neighborhood. I grew up in a little town in southeastern Kansas, by the way. And there's a flower that grows out there, and it's called an iris. You might know them as flags here. And I was right about 3 and a half years old, walking down this street, and there was these neat purple flowers, and I had this grand idea that I would take these things home. I'd pick some and take them home and give them to my mother. And that's a grand idea. Nothing wrong with that idea. A couple of little problems. They weren't my flowers to pick, but I didn't think about that in that moment in time. But I picked those flowers, and I took them home. And my mother, who, by the way, is as honest as anybody I've ever seen, and, by the way, she has 72 years of sobriety, she said to me, son, where did you get those flowers? And I said, I don't know. That rolled out of my mouth just as easily as I just shared it with you. And at that moment in time, I convinced myself that I didn't know. I can tell you precisely where I picked those flowers, and I'm 57 years old. I know the people who lived there. I know their first name, their last name. They've been dead for 25 years, and I still know the name. I knew exactly where I got those. But you see, I'm also found in the doctor's opinion, which is so very valuable to me. And if the doctor says, we're the type of people who are incapable of distinguishing between the true and the false. See, I said, I don't know where I got those flowers, and immediately I didn't know where I got those flowers. I couldn't distinguish between true and the false. I had intended to do the right thing. I was trying to be good, you understand? And because I was trying to be good, then you should see me as good. As I look over my entire life, one of the things that gets to be fun about this deal is, Don mentioned drama just a little bit. I get to take the drama out of my life. And let's just look at the facts. We'll just look at the facts of my life. And the facts of my life are simply this, from the time I was young, not too long after the flower incident, my mother and her sister, my aunt, began to have meetings. And the context of those meetings was, what are we going to do with this boy? I had three younger brothers now, and they never held meetings about those younger brothers. And my life truly went on and on and on like this. And as I got older, then it was my mother and a school teacher. And then it was my mother and a school principal. And I'll shorten the length of that and just tell you that by the tail end of my little career, it was a bunch of people, including a judge, Kansas Bureau of Investigation, some folks that had some power. And along the way, I'd had a doctor when I was 35 years old say I had an alcoholic seizure and died. And he said, and he managed to pull me out of that. He had been a Navy doctor specializing in alcoholism. And he knew a little bit about what he was doing, and he said that, Jerry, and he knew me very well, by the way, isn't that terrible if you have to go to somebody who's treating you for alcoholism and they know you real well and you're just humiliated to beat all hell and you don't know what to do? And he said to me, he said, Jerry, you need to never take another drink again. And that was November of 1975, Thanksgiving of 1975. And 4 days later, I was back at the same old pace that I had been. You see, and that's a fact now, and what I'm saying, I like to look at facts. I couldn't quit drinking. I don't care what the threat was. The threat was, if you ever take another drink, Jerry, your tolerance to alcohol is about gone. You've had one alcoholic seizure and died. If you drink again, there's no telling how little it may take, and you'll die again. Only this time, we won't be able to do anything about it. And I had lived in that hopeless state of mind and body that first forward mentions so long, you know what? Truth matters, I didn't care. I really, truly just didn't care. And I've heard it said, and I've heard it in a lot of meetings, and I don't identify with it. People say, oh, I set out to get drunk from my very first drink. And I didn't. I didn't ever set out to get drunk. Never did set out to get drunk, by the way. Tell you what I set out to do. I discovered my first drink that I could be okay. Very first drink. I can still remember my first drink. Oh, my God. For the very first time, that hole in my stomach that they talk about, a hole, whatever you want to call it, was gone. But more than anything else, I remember for the very first time that I was okay. And God Almighty, I love the feeling of just being okay. My mind quieted down just a little bit. And that terrible gnawing, that sense that I lived for a long time with that sense that something bad was going to happen. Usually it did. And when it did, you know, I'd always have that same question, what in the hell is wrong with me? And as if I go through the doctor's opinion, I can tell you what they would say about me today. They would say, this boy has an attention deficit disorder. That's what they'd say. And see, I'm the type who would start each year as a young man, each year in class, and I'd start, well, I remember the 13 and 14 and 15, by God, this semester, this class, I'm going to do a great job. I'm going to pay attention because I've always been accused of not paying attention. And I'd start that class, and I could hang on for a little while. And then the next thing, I'm either looking out the window, I'm thinking about her,
I'm thinking about athletics. Whatever it is I'm thinking about, it sure as hell isn't what they're talking about in the classroom. And that's with me doing the very best that I can do. I mean, see, I don't have what it takes to live in this world. I gotta have something better than what I came here with. And it took me a little while to figure that all out. See, I watched my wife. I'm married to a very beautiful woman. And she's quite sane. She will drink a little glass of wine, and I watch it. God, I love to watch her. She drinks this little glass of wine, and she will only drink it if it tastes right. Now, I got to tell you that. It's got to have a certain taste. I mean, it can be too sweet, and she won't drink it. Being too dry, she won't drink it. And have too much of a woody taste, she won't drink it. She get all these reasons. And then she drinks a little glass. I wouldn't waste the time getting the damn glass out, but she does. She's got this little teeny tiny glass, and she drinks that, and I say, honey, you know, I'm alky. I mean, after all these years, that's a good question to ask yourself. Am I really alcoholic? I tell you how I can still, one of the ways I can still tell you I'm alcoholic, it gets clear to me, is I watch her and I think, she should have another. So I say to her, because I'm such a magnanimous man, I say to her, darling, you want another? I'll go get it. And she says, no, no. And I say, why not? And she says, I'm starting to feel it. I say, oh, really? What do you feel? And she says, I feel like I'm losing control. See, I don't know about you all, but I get control when I drink. I had an illusion that I was starting to get things under control. You know, I come home at night after working as a young man, and I had a lot of promise. People kept telling me, Jerry, you got a lot of promise. And you know, my day would be all scrambled up, at least from on the inside looking at it, looked kind of messed up, and my mind would be very noisy, and I could have a drink, and my mind would begin to quiet down. And whatever was going on all over me physically would begin to quiet down, and I'd have a sense of everything's okay. Everything's okay. And see, with that, I get control. I'm starting to get control of all these problems. And so I watched my little sane wife, and she said, no, I'm physically different than she is. I have three younger brothers. By the way, during my drinking career, when I was having had such a grand time riding around in patrol cars with handcuffs on, I thought my brothers were nerds. I don't know if anybody else has got nerdy brothers or not. They keep the same job. They pay their bills. They don't go to jail. They never have the Kansas Bureau of Investigation talking to them. And nobody's holding meetings about them, but they're nerds, see? I'm hip, slick, and cool. You talk about being incapable of distinguishing between the true and the false. I have a problem. And I am the last one that knew it. I'm the last one that knew it. People, see, have known for years that there is something wrong with me, and I didn't know it. I kept thinking, no, if I give this thing called living one more real good shot, this time I'll get it right. And I never did get it right. I never did get it right. I was given the gift of physical sobriety in a kind of a tough way. I had been sent off one more time. They were going to lock me away in a maximum security mental institution over in Kansas. And if I just say locked away anywhere in Kansas, that's punishment enough, isn't it? at least it. Anyway, that's what they were going to do. And I got lucky. A guy came along. He said, I really think you're dealing with a young man who's alcoholic. I can make this very brief. He said, why don't you send him to this place here? And so they sent me off to a place. And they kept trying to introduce me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm still trying to figure this whole thing out. And I'm not going to any meetings. I'll do whatever I have to do here to keep everybody off my case. And I'd been doing that for years. I figured out, okay, what is it you want me to do and be for a little while, and I can do that for a little while. And After a few days in this place, I figured out a way to smuggle booze in, see? Because and there's another little clue as to what I really am. I don't care where you put me, if my mind goes to that point of saying I need a drink, because not drinking is an intolerable situation. Without any other solution, just not drinking is totally intolerable to me. Just waking up another day is intolerable to me if I don't have some solution. So I figured out a way to get a drink into this place, and a couple of days later, I took a couple of drinks, and I fell flat on my face, passed out, totally passed out, and I came to, and the lady was standing there, and she said, "Jerry, I don't know what we're going to do with you." The same conversation I'd heard my whole life. What are we going to do? She said, "The staff's going to meet. We're going to decide what to do with you. I think they're just going to send you over to the mental institution, put you away for the rest of your life." And I said, "Well, is there anything I can do?" She said, "Yeah, you can go pray." Now, in that kind of a spot where you already know, way down deep inside of you, see, I knew that I was a low life. I was just a low life. I knew that. I don't care what I looked like on the outside. I knew I was low. And when a guy's in that kind of condition, who are you going to pray to? You know, I walked in AA years later, a little while later, and people said, "You got to get a relationship with your higher power." Listen, I've lived such a sleazy life that how am I going to get a relationship with God? It just can't be done. And so I go to this little chapel to pray, and I sit there and I think, how in the world am I going to do this? What am I going to pray to? I mean, the God that I understood isn't going to answer a little scammy guy like me, answer my prayers. He's just not going to do it. Because, see, I knew what my life was. I knew how dishonest it had been. Well, I had just a little bit of clarity at that moment in time. Finally, I thought, you know, my time's about up. They're getting ready to come and get me. They're going to haul me away. And long toward the end of there, I thought, oh, to hell with it. I quit. I'm through. I give up. I didn't even know what I was doing. I had given up. And that was January the 17th, 1977. And that's when the gift of physical sobriety was given to me, when I finally quit and gave up. There's nothing worse than an alky who starts feeling better. You know, 90 days later, I'm back out on the streets. I'm doing a lot of whining in those early days. When are you going to let me have some of the responsibility and jobs like I used to have? And people aren't willing to do that. They're gonna see how this whole thing shakes loose. And so I just went to a lot of meetings for a lot of years. Quote, kept myself sober. Wasn't that a dandy deal? Man who'd never been able to quit in his entire life, no matter what he was threatened with, including death. And I'm going to go out there and keep myself sober. 13 years go by, and life truly is totally intolerable. I mean, completely and totally intolerable. And I think, my God, what am I going to do? And way over toward the tail end of the doctor's opinion, I found a little deal in there that says his problems are so complex and his depression is so great. My God, that's what I'm talking about. That's what I am. My problems are... See, I thought there was all sorts of things wrong with me. But when I went back and I began to look at things like that, the way my wife is about not wanting to drink anymore, she'll lose control or starting to feel it, and she pushes away. I'm physically different than my brothers. I'm physically different than the non-alcoholic. I'm physically different than my wife. And that was